for years I was one of them, and I couldn't afford to go home. And so, you know, sometimes you'd get an invitation, but a lot of times it doesn't even occur to people that you don't have a place to go. So we thought, you know, threw this out there. So we have about 16 people right now coming, so it's a nice group, and maybe there'll be more.
I'm sure there will be.
Yeah, right. So, okay. We quickly will do one more beatitude, and, you know, I think I'm going to complete the charisms the next time, because Shauna had really been the one that seemed really wanting to hear a lot of it more about it, so we'll do that for her, too. But, okay, so moving right along, we are at blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. I'm correct, we didn't do that one yet, right? We didn't.
No, we did
meekness last time, I think. Yeah, we did meekness. So, you know, the thing I always remember is in this one, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, because we're talking about, again, Christianity is not about being a nice person, a nice guy. It's not a good civil arrangement. It's about being a bit radical. And that's what the Beatitudes are. They're defining a way of life that would be a kind of a radical, you know, we call it in Latin the sequela Christi, the radical following of Christ. And the Beatitudes, if you really take them seriously and say, I'm going to just have these as a model for my life, then that would be living the Christ life, living truly a Christian life. Most of us don't radically live the Beatitudes. We kind of get along, you know, we take the next best step. So I remember a story, there's a great story when we were studying prayer again in the convent, and it's from Eastern religions. This guy, Anthony de Mello, was a Jesuit, and he studied the Eastern religions, but he wrote a story of there was a Chinese spiritual leader, and, you know, the way they have them, you know, up in the mountains, whatever, gurus, and that would be Indian, but whatever they call them in China. But his disciples would always be pulling at him, tell us how to pray. And one was particularly vehement about saying to the master, teach me how to pray. And so finally the master said, okay, well, I'll take you and I'll show you how. So we're going to go to the river. So they went to the river, and so the master said, okay, come out in the river with me. And they went out, he took the kid by his hair and shoved him under the water. And so the kid was, you know, went with it for a while, and finally then started to really need, you know, air, and started, you know, really trying to get out. And finally, right before he's about to expire, the master, you know, let him up. And he's like, what are you, crazy old man? You know, what did you do? And the master said, well, until you want God as much as you wanted air, you really can't pray. And I think in the sense of the Beatitude, that has a good application here. You know, to say hunger and thirst for righteousness. I mean, it's one thing to be mildly distressed by injustice, occasionally preoccupied by the idea that somewhere out there, like, for example, right across the street, we have the Dance of the Seven Veil place, right? So right across the street, catty-corner to us, we could throw a baseball, women are being horribly, horribly exploited. And men are being horribly exploited too, right? Right there. Now, how many of us are, like, is that any kind of a thought in our head, you know? Or, you know?
Only because I went there, I got confused on the address, and I was like, are they sharing the building?
So, you know, but I mean, in truth, we know how horribly destructive that kind of a thing is. It becomes a chain on people's souls, and on the women's side, completely destroys their ability to see themselves not in a purely sexual context, and, you know, have their true value. So this is a horrible thing that we should be preoccupied by. I mean, more than preoccupied by. You know, it shouldn't be that when you drive by, it's like, oh, that awful place, right? It should be dwelling at this. And there's so much like that. That if you really, really hunger and thirst for righteousness, you would be a little bit of a raving person. You know, it would be hard. It would be much harder to live and breathe and laugh and walk. You know, somehow we should be a bit grim, I think, because of the way the world is. And, you know, there's no record of Christ laughing in the Gospels. It never says Jesus laughed. And always I thought that was interesting. But if, as St. John says, he knew what was in the heart of men. And imagine that. At all moments, he has this knowledge, this profound knowledge of what is in the heart of men. And every time he walks into a village or a home, he's aware of all of the stuff going on, all the darkness and all of the patterns of evil. And it's, how do you laugh, really, you know, with that? So I think that the Beatitude is calling for us to desire an end to evil the way you would that man in the river desired air. You know, that it would be that much of a consuming passion. And that's, in fact, the only way you ever do anything to make a difference, is that something gets to you. And you know, you kind of have to pick your issue, because we can't fix them all. But whatever it is that your heart leads you to be horrified by, go with it, in that sense, because that will give you the energy, I think, to take that area of injustice on and say, you know, this is the one that I just can't get out of my head, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned this and I missed the others, because this is something I've struggled with. When I was 13, without getting too mm-hmm. involved, I worked at a shelter called the Community for Creative Nonviolence in D.C. under a man named Mitch Snyder, mm-hmm. who was an anti-Vietnam War mm-hmm. radical, who then gave his life and devoted it to combating homelessness, mm-hmm. and ended up. You know him? Have you heard of him?
No, but I mean, this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. But yeah,
he mm-hmm. went on fasts mm-hmm. for one of them lasted 40 plus days on just water, mm-hmm. to the point where he stopped breathing. And his argument was, and it was a pressure on Congress to appropriate $5 million for a state-of-the-art shelter that would rehabilitate homeless individuals mm-hmm. and reintegrate them into society. Mm-hmm. And it passed, and people would say, well, that's like manipulation. But he said,
I had to do something.
It's to rescue people yeah. from a burning building.
Right,
and
I
struggled with my own upper middle class upbringing mm-hmm. and the Bible verse, you know, it's far easier for a rich man to fit or a fat man to fit mm-hmm. through the eye of a needle mm-hmm. eye of the needle than it is for a rich man to mm-hmm. enter heaven. And I went home at age 13 for the rest of my spring break after having been at the shelter, and was so conflicted, mm. and mm-hmm. it's a cause that's, I see, mm-hmm. I Christ is a radical, mm-hmm. and I believe I'm probably living mm-hmm. at odds with what he taught.
Well, I mean, then, you know, start today, you know, find your thing that your heart is stirred by, and throw yourself into that in some way, and, you know, there it is, you know. But I mean, I think that the first hunger and thirst for righteousness should be in our own lives and hearts, like our own, that, you know, it's got to start there, where, you know, we all have to begin with that and say, you know, so that you kind of go to the Eucharist and say, I'm really, really, I really, really stand in need of you. And I have nothing else. I really stand in need of you. And that's the kind of the only, what else do you say, you know, at that moment? But, you know, I think we talk ourselves out of the good motives that come to us so often because, you know, it's just not the right moment, or it's kind of awkward, or, you know, I don't have time today, or I'm not gonna be able to persevere. I know so many people who don't start out doing anything good because they don't think they'll be able to do it in 4 months or 6 months, or, you know, it's just like amazing. And it's kind of like, well, you don't have 4 months, but today you have today, you know. So whatever your passion is, whatever the thing is that stirs your heart, give yourself to that. It's amazing when you hear the stories. Like, I remember I did a lot of work on Dorothy Day once for a movie project, and Dorothy Day said, somebody said to her once, you know, you've done such great work, you spent 54 years at that point, 54 years, you know, working with the poor in New York, and they were like, you're such a saint. And it was actually the priest that I worked for that he said this to her. And she said to him, everything I've done in penance for the abortion I had in my youth. And it just completely put the whole thing in perspective. You know, here's this woman who had fed at that point hundreds of thousands of people and had made such a difference. But there it was for her. She was doing it as an act of atonement, but she allowed herself to do it. That's what I'm saying the difference is, that a lot of us, good things flit through our head, but to really hunger and thirst, for righteousness would be to let yourself go with whatever passion of your heart. Yes.
Can you, I don't know how quite to put this, but can you have a radical reaction to something that you feel is unjust and needs change for the good of yourself and others without having a radical reaction? In other words, let's take the example of the seven veils.
What do you do
the
there?
Street.
Yeah.
All right. It's abhorrent to women alone.
Yeah.
Okay, without the moral implications. Yeah. But you could protest and walk outside with a sign and say this is a den of iniquity, or you can work slowly inside the system and get it closed.
Yeah. You could.
So can this radical behavior be accomplished without radical consequences?
Well, I mean, I think you have to find the way to do it, and everybody's going to have different ways of approaching it. You know, that might, like the knowledge of that place, if that one is the one that gets to you, it might lead you into work with young women, you know, who are in trouble. You know, I have a friend who works a program called Right Girl, which is an inner city urban program to help high school girls who are at risk become writers, like to write their stories. And it was started by some members of the Writers Guild of America who were like, we're writers, we're not going to feed the homeless. But they came up with this thing, and it's been amazing. They got a huge award this year from the Humanitas Prize because so many young women have gone on from being in that program to go to college and then have said that that program, because it gave them an outlet and it made them think and all of this stuff. So I think the answer to your question is, if you say to God, I hate this thing. I hate this evil that's in the world, you know, whatever it is. Help me do something. Show me what to do. He will. And you'll get inclinations, and it'll be amazing. But most of us, how many of us make that prayer? You know, we don't. We don't have time to really do any good. And remember, you know, the scriptures are very clear. When Jesus says, you know, here it is, at the end of the world, the Son of Man will come and say, you fed me when I was hungry, you clothed me, you visited me in prison, you took care of me when I was sick, come and inherit the kingdom. And the people said, when did we do that? And then, you know, he says, and then the others, he says, you never. So salvation, there is a relationship between how we acted and where we're going to end up. And Jesus himself says it. I mean, it's like, no, works don't save you, but they're not irrelevant either. And some of us just don't have that much to show, really anything that costs us. And some people shame us. I mean, when you see some people and what they do for other people, you know, my mother pretty much every week for, like, I don't know, 40 years has been going to a nursing home visiting the elderly. She just does it. And she brings them cakes and things and sits with them on their birthday. And it's her thing. She spends, you know, 3 hours a week at the nursing home. And so I said to my sister once, she's like complaining about mom. And I said, you cannot say anything against mom because the angels in heaven have been watching her for 40 years do this thing. And it covers, mom used to say, charity covers a multitude of sin. And I think this is very true. So whatever your thing is, find it and then do it and do it consistently to the point of where it stops being rewarding in the way it really is in the beginning when you're like, I go to the nursing home every day. Because in the beginning, everything feels like that. But then there's a point, you know, what your 80th visit, where it's not fun anymore. But it's something you do. And, you know, my thing is instruct the ignorant, counsel the doubtful. You know, I was saying to my husband about Brideshead. I was reading it last night, and he said, you know, how many years have you taught this class? And I said, I mean, this is not boasting. It's just being honest. I was like, oh, well, it's about going about 14 years. And he goes, so you've read that book 14 times, and you're reading it again for tomorrow. I was like, it's what I do. It's my one thing. And so I have to do it as well as I can because I'm such a sinner. So there it goes, you know. But anyway, it's not about boasting. I'm just sharing that's my thing. And I had to find my thing. I tried to work at a shelter by the airport, and they wanted me to do marketing. So, you know, finally I found my thing. Yeah.
So if I understand what you're saying correctly, and I, I don't see it as rationalizing. I mean, I could just give all my worldly possessions to a shelter or a guy on the corner. Or I can cultivate my God-given gifts that each of us has, like we're a unique fingerprint of God's grace, so that I can kind of, in essence, affect the change in a way that is honoring the gifts that God gave me, the talents.
Yeah, and if God could save you any other way than by giving you that thing that's bugging you, he would. But, you know, like, that's the trick of the whole thing, is that your salvation will be wrapped up in that action. The thing that you're being drawn to or called to is first and foremost the way God is going to save you. So I think we have to give ourselves to our good or neutral inclinations. And that, when you talk about hungering and thirsting for righteousness' sake, I mean, the person who's really starving to death is a bit desperate. And that's the language Christ used. You know, blessed are they who hunger and thirst for this stuff, the way other people do for food. And that, you know, I've met people that have, like, in the pro-life movement, I met people who, I mean, I'm absolutely pro-life, you know, whatever, for me, it's a big E, but I know people that it's their ongoing, they can't think of anything but, you know, this terrible thing. And that's their thing. And they've spent, you know, I know a woman in Rhode Island, and she was so, you know, they couldn't change the laws, but so she opened a crisis pregnancy center. And three crisis pregnancy centers and an evangelization center, because then she has, like, all these women that they had their pregnancy. So then she had to start a school for them because they didn't have training and job training and education. So she had they went the Mother of Christ Evangelization Center after they had their babies and with their babies. And then it was an adoption placement agency. And it was just, like, one thing after another. But that, to me, is somebody who has fought. She just couldn't say no because of, you know, she hungered and thirsted in this area. So, you know, she's got 400 babies on her bulletin board. That's pretty good by any standard. One would be good, you know. So I throw that out, and everybody has to, you have to give in some way that hurts and costs you. You've got to find what that is. There's no salvation, I think, without it. Christ is clear about that. Those who call me Lord, Lord, but haven't done these things, I don't know you. So there it is. Okay, good. Bride's Head Revisited. Okay. All right, how many of you, truthfully, tell the truth, how many of you read the book? One, most two, three, most of it. You did most of it. You read half of it. Did you read any of it?
I read it in college.
You read it in college, so you're an expert then.
No,
and,
no. I gave a report, and I think that's
you. Okay, I think this is one of the most important books of the 20th century. I really think it's that vital. And I think as a Catholic, when you talk about a Catholic novel, I think it's probably in the top three. So it's, to me, it's a must read. In fact, it's kind of a must linger over and a must dwell. I've read it now probably 15 times, and I'm amazed by what he did in this novel. I think there's so many ways we could start here, but I kind of want to just briefly say, let's just go through the plot so that for everybody who didn't finish it or get it, we all know kind of what happened. And then I'm going to throw out a couple questions and see where it takes us, okay? But so basically the plot, rather to save time, I'm going to do it. You have the young man, the scion of a family named Sebastian Flight, who is encountered by the, actually I should say, the main character in the book is a guy named Charles, who we meet in the army. And they're staying on the grounds of this big estate, and he realizes that it's Bride's Head and that he'd been here before, maybe 5 or 6 years before, and that, in fact, now we hear that he had actually spent quite a lot of time here. And it's the estate of this family called the Flights, and he, Charles, had met the scion of the family, Sebastian, when he was at Oxford, and had become absolutely one of those British schoolboy friendships where they absolutely were attached to each other, Sebastian and Charles. Charles comes of a family that's an old, dusty, British, Protestant family that has not a lot of intimacy. He doesn't seem to have a mother. There's no mention of her, really. So his relationship with his father is an emotionless man. But then he meets the Flights, and the Flights, he experiences like a whirlwind of personality and what the book calls charm, which we're going to talk about. And he's consumed by the Flights. And it begins with Sebastian, and then he gets swept up into the family, and then ends up having an affair with the daughter, Julia. So he falls in love with Julia and realizes his love for Sebastian was, as he says, Sebastian was just the forerunner. Like, I thought that was love, nothing compared to what I feel for Julia. So he falls in love with Julia, and but Julia, unfortunately, is married to, she made a marriage with a non-Catholic, Rex, who converted nominally to Catholicism, or was going to. Well, but what happened was right before they get married, they found out Rex had contracted a marriage with somebody else. So Julia, who has committed herself to Rex, she just wants out, basically, of her life and family. So she just decides to marry Rex and does, ends up leaving the church to do it. So then when Charles meets her, she's kind of left Rex at that point. It's been a terrible situation. And so then they have this affair. Sebastian disappears, and we hear he's living, ministering to an awful guy named Kurt, who's got a putrid, wounded foot that Sebastian cleans out. Sebastian has become a complete dipsomaniac, a complete alcoholic. And then there's Cordelia, who's the other daughter of the family who had tried to be a nun and didn't make it and left. And so she's kind of just there. And then there's Bridie, the oldest son, who marries, whose only real passion is he collects matchboxes. But then he marries a Miss, what's her name? Anyway, he marries an older widow, and there it is. The father of the family is in Italy living in sin with a woman named Cara, who is lovely. And all of a sudden, they get word that the father is coming home to die. The mother dies at some point. She dies kind of out of off camera, you know, we would say, but she just kind of disappears. So then the father lets them know he's coming home to die, comes back in, and suddenly they're all kind of gathered around again. And really the only one practicing their faith, that Bridie and Cordelia are still in the faith. Sebastian's gone, and Julia is living in sin. But they find themselves around their father's deathbed. And basically, a debate starts up of how are we going to get Father the last rites? And Charles is completely frustrated by this dialogue because the father lived outside the church his whole adult life, and then he feels it's extremely manipulative. And they all kind of get very sad and quiet when he says these things, and then they kind of go right back to, well, we need to get a priest, you know, in the end. And Charles thinks they've lost their minds. He thinks they're kind of insane. But there it is. Finally, at the very end, they do get a priest in there. The first time, he threw something at him, but the second time, the father's so far gone, they bring a priest in. And you have this scene at the end where Charles is watching the priest go through the last rites over the body, and the father's looks like he's almost gone. And Charles makes a prayer and says, for the sake of this woman I love, if you are there, God, give them some sign that you're there. And all of a sudden, the old man's hand moves up, and he makes the sign of the cross at the end of the last rites. Then he dies, and the priest says, ah, lovely death. I've seen a lot of them fight till the very end, and there it is, right? And so all the Catholics are, like, so happy and relieved, and of course, it was a miracle, and it was a miracle wrought by Charles' prayer. But at that point, then Julia kind of looks at him, and it's like, it's over. It has to be. There's no place for us to go. And so they break off at that point. And then Julia and Cordelia go off to World War II and become nurses in France somewhere. And there it is. And they kind of just disappear, and the whole family kind of goes away. And we hear Sebastian's dying somewhere, dead. That's pretty much it. And so Charles revisits this entire thing, standing there at Bride's Head, and all of a sudden kind of walks away at the very end. Now he's a soldier, and he's revisited the whole thing, and he's in the chapel. And the last line of the book, and it's been, you know, he's been a grim thing for many years now because of his not, you know, his life is not good. But I quickened my pace and reached the hut, which served us for our anteroom. "You're looking unusually cheerful today," said the second in command. And that's the last line of the book. So Charles, this experience, this revisiting of Brideshead has brought joy to him in some way, and he's going to be different now. So that's the story in very broad strokes. And there's lots of other things I didn't say, but okay. The question I wanted to throw out just to get us started is I want to go through some of the characters and basically ask this question: what's their problem? So I thought the best one to start with is Sebastian. What is Sebastian's problem? And if you have the book and you want to make reference to it, you know, I have a thing when I read a book of, you know, I make notes, I write all over my books. But like, so anything significant for Sebastian's character is here. I have all these page numbers, you know, and then I have that, you know, I have one for Antony and one for Lady Mara Charles. And so that I have, you know, and I just do this pretty much when I read with the character. So I recommend that to you too. When you make another pass over this book, which I hope you'll do, go through and kind of note when they give you, when he gives you a detail about Sebastian or any of the characters, you know, make a note and say, this is something telling me about him. But what is Sebastian's problem? What do you think?
I think he has no interest. He just doesn't have any passion in life.
Sebastian has no passion in life. Now,
he doesn't have any hobbies.
Except for,
nothing.
Except for alcohol at a certain point. Now,
well,
now,
that's why maybe he came to that, because he could not find interest in anything. Like even his friend Charles, he loved painting, and Sebastian seems...
You know, I think you're right. I think he gets to a point where he loses all passion in life.
Yeah, he grew up in a wealthy family, but he didn't have a father next to him who would guide him and tell him what to look for in life, and he didn't really know...
The question is, what made him lose passion in life? What happened to Sebastian to make him lose the passion in life?
He's mentally ill.
You think he's mentally ill?
Okay,
he's mentally ill. Now, I think it's the kind of thing where sin makes you crazy. I think it's that kind of, because it would be too simple just to say he's just, you know, kind of just mentally ill. Like, in this kind of situation, the novel, the situation of the novel is Sebastian goes through a change, right? He, when we meet him at first, he's so full of charm. Let me read you the room of Sebastian. It's on page 31 in my book. But when Charles first goes to his room, now remember, think of Charles' house growing up. It's very gray and drab. It's dusty and dark. His father has no adornments and no interest at all. Well, this is the description of Sebastian's room. Well, first of all, he says about Sebastian, he was magically beautiful, with that epicene quality which in extreme youth sings aloud for love and withers at the first cold wind. His room was filled with a strange jumble of objects, a harmonium in a Gothic case, an elephant's foot waste paper basket, a dome of wax fruit, two disproportionately large Sèvres vases, framed drawings by Daumier, made all the more incongruous by the austere college furniture. There was a large luncheon table, and his chimney piece was covered with cards of invitation from London hostesses. This is kind of a cool... colorful. This is somebody who has passion in life, right? And then remember, one of the first things they do together is they go out and they sit under the tree and they drink champagne and strawberries. And Charles has never done anything like this before. But that is the kind of thing he discovers with Sebastian, is the beauty of life. Yes.
Which I hate to keep chiming in, but mm-hmm. I'm so excited by this because... They're hallmarks of mania, these mm-hmm. fantastical kind of grandiose ideas mm-hmm. of the elephant's foot, all these invitations, the harmonium. They're all like uncompleted, unfulfilled, hobbies that one pursues in fits of mania that never completes.
But don't you think an elephant vase is kind of cool?
Oh, I do.
Right, I do.
I'm not speaking.
It's just eclectic interior design.
Very good. It's eclectic interior design. Right. Yeah.
I see it because I'm bipolar.
Right. Uh-huh.
And I have these.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm not laughing. I'm just.
Oh no, it's okay.
I find it interesting. Go ahead.
He has these unfinished projects.
Mm-hmm.
The that I see, and this bear that he talks to.
Okay, very good. I like the bear.
And he gets
mm-hmm.
depressed.
Yes.
And alcohol,
mm-hmm.
which is a spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Spirits, it's the Holy Spirit or the liquid spirit.
Yeah.
People need one or the other or both.
I will cure his
bipolar.
I will give you that Sebastian ends up in a kind of depression, and actually it grows through the story. And so that... I think he's quite mad by the end. I mean, living with Kurt in the way he's living and with the monks, I think this is a man who's fallen into a little bit of madness. The question is, how does he get there and why? But you made a point, one of the crucial details of Sebastian is Aloysius. Huh? Who's Aloysius? Anybody remember?
The teddy bear.
Okay. He names his teddy bear, Aloysius. Anybody know who Saint Aloysius was?
Patron saint of young people.
Very good. Saint Aloysius was a 14-year-old boy who died, huh? He's the patron saint of young people. And Sebastian knows this, right? He's been raised by Nanny Hawkins and has been raised in the faith with all the saints. So he has his teddy bear is Aloysius. What's a guy in college doing with a teddy bear anyway?
Not wanting to grow up.
Not wanting to grow up. Very good.
And it was interesting. He doesn't really care. So to me, I think that he came there like a boy just to impress everybody.
Mm-hmm.
He's from a wealthy family. He mm-hmm. drinks the champagne, the strawberries.
Yeah.
He does. And Charles... I think her cousin told him that by second year you would shake off most of your worthless friends, and
yeah.
that would happen. And apparently, like at the end of the year, that's when they visit their father in Venice, and that's
yeah.
when this depression started,
mm-hmm.
I guess, and
yeah.
this alcohol desire.
I think when he got a close-up look at his father, who he had kind of made his in his mind, this I'm going to be like Dad. I'm not going to be. What? Like who? Not going to be like mom.
Like a family.
Not going to do what mom wants. I'm going to be like Dad. And then he goes and stays with Dad for a couple months. And then it's like, Dad is not happy. So now what do I do? I think Sebastian, when you talk about Sebastian's problem, this thing of not growing up is his problem. I don't want to grow up. I want to be a little boy. And so I think one of the things that Catholicism is asking, kind of cutting right through here to the, to the bone, but in the book, Catholicism is asking you to grow up, not to be a little boy anymore. And he feels that. His mother's challenge is, you have to be responsible. You have to be an adult. You have to stop being a narcissist. You have to grow up. You have to take responsibility. Now, what's the thing you mostly have to take responsibility for? What's the fundamental adultness of Christianity, or in particularly Catholicism, is sin. You have to take responsibility for your behavior, for your sin. And that is the bugaboo for the bride's head, for the flights. Flight itself is a great word, right? Flight. These people live in flight. And this is expressed mainly in the two kids, Julia and Sebastian, who are in flight. Now, Cordelia and Bridie have they've acclimated themselves. They're not fleeing it. And especially Cordelia, who I think is a saint in the story.
Right, the not prodigal son.
Yes, she's not the one. And you know, Bridie is, he's kind of got a cold, self-righteous version of Catholicism. Cordelia is just love and mercy and no judgment. So I think But even Cordelia has this suffering of she wanted to be a nun, but she didn't have a vocation. And there it is. So her life kind of unfolds, and he meets her later on, and she looks to him to be a spinsterish kind of thing. And he feels for her like, what a waste. But I don't think there's a waste there at all. It's just that her, even Cordelia's had suffering in her life. But so this problem of Sebastian, though, to return, just to keep focusing on, because it becomes, it's one of the essential things. The attraction for Charles to Sebastian is that Sebastian is living, he appears to be living without care. But in fact, he's living with tremendous anxiety, which is he doesn't want to surrender to the Christian thing, to be a grown-up, to be responsible. And there's a great scene where they go into the chapel and Charles watches Sebastian dunk his hand in the font, you know, the baptismal font, and bless himself. And Charles says, what do you do that? It's you know, just some silly superstition or something. And Charles and Sebastian says, oh, if only it was.
That was funny.
If only it was. But it isn't. And so even though Sebastian is acting like a rebel, Charles sees him, well, why don't you just shake it off? And it's like, you know, again, you have the line where at dinner when Charles says to the flights, why did you always have to bring up religion? And Cordelia says, well, it's kind of already there, isn't it? It's just there. Now, Charles is an English Protestant. He's coming into this strange arena of these Catholics. And his feeling is being around them, they're obsessed with religion. Like, why can't they just be like other British people? And just, you know, okay, we're Christians. Why do you have to be obsessed with religion? That's one of the questions of the book. What is it that is so in them that is, as Evelyn Waugh calls it, that Catholic thing? You know, what's the thing that's driving them all crazy in one way or the other?
Are they conflicted between their secular surroundings and the demands of their faith?
I think that they're trying to reconcile it's the charm thing. The charm thing is, and we're going to move into that in a minute. But I think fundamentally what you have is the Catholic faith, because it's grounded in earthy things, the sacraments, is all about a celebration of the world and life. And it says, drink wine, champagne, and eat strawberries, because it's good to taste and experience the world. Protestantism basically says the body is bad and suspect. So, but because of the sacraments, the Catholics are open to creation. The problem is, how do you not go overboard? So the question of being a grown-up and learning to moderate. You know, Julia loves Charles, but you can't have Charles. You know, you can't have Charles because you're married to someone else. And so she says, forget that. I don't care. I don't care anymore. I don't want to think about that. I want Charles. And the same way that Sebastian doesn't want to think about it. He doesn't want to think about having to every day brood and take the next best step. He just wants to live without thinking. In some ways, the way his father lives. And his father lives a very cold, lifeless, bloodless existence. And that's what Charles is coming from. And so the question is, Charles is coming out of that. Initially, he is welcomed into the flight's world, and it's almost, you know, he calls it moving from Puritanism to the Baroque, right? But then when you're in the Baroque, now you have to be moderate. And the Baroque is dangerous. In a way,
the Baroque is all the frilly kind of.
Well, right. It's you know, it's beauty and
it's big and boisterous.
Big and boisterous and you know and yeah and yeah and sensual.
That's what Charles equates Protestantism and his life with Puritanism.
Yeah.
And Catholicism, the Catholicism of the flights to Baroque.
To Baroque, yeah. In fact, there's a great. I'll read you the section. It's on page 82 in my book. But he says, Since days when, as a schoolboy, I used to ride my bicycle around the neighboring parishes, rubbing brasses and photographing fonts, I have nursed a love of architecture. But though in opinion, I made that easy leap, characteristic of my generation, from the Puritanism of Ruskin to the Puritanism of Roger Fry. My sentiments at heart were insular and medieval. Okay, so this is British Protestantism. He's talking about insular and medieval. Then he says, meeting the flights, this was my conversion to the Baroque. You know, here under that high and insolent dome, those tricky ceilings, here I passed through those arches and broken pediments to the pillared shade beyond and sat hour by hour before the fountain, probing its shadows, tracing its lingering echoes, rejoicing in all its clustered feats of daring and invention. I felt a whole new system of nerves alive within me, as though the water that spurted and bubbled among the stones was a life-giving spring. This is a reference to baptism, of course. So in being around the flights, he gets a kind of a baptism.
It's reflected in his paintings, too, because
exactly.
He's linear in his architectural painting, but then he starts painting Julia's body, right?
Yeah.
But
even the paintings he does in the flight's living room, or parlor there, or whatever, it's supposed to be quite beautiful. And actually, before he goes off, you know, you never hear of Charles have painted before. But being around the flights, he starts to paint.
He just learned.
Yeah, he just learned, right? They bring it out of him. And the question is how and why. But we're going to go back to charm again. But I just want to go back to this Sebastian's problem, the refusal to grow up. Because I think this, more than anything, is a very, very, very common problem, and especially in the modern world, where we have a resistance to really, really taking our faith seriously because we're afraid of where it's going to lead us. We're afraid of what it's going to ask of us. We're afraid of changing, really. And that's the Sebastian problem. You know, a little bit about what we're talking about with the Beatitudes. I don't want to hang around with those religious people because I don't want to become one of those people who ends up working at shelters. You know? I don't want to be one of those people. I don't want to end up singing in a choir. I don't want to end up with all that guilt. I don't want to end up, you know, living in reconciliation, as we would say, which is kind of a drag, constantly saying you're sorry, trying to brood over the next best step, you know, every day starting over. I don't want to live like that. I just don't want to be there. And I think that more than anything, this is what keeps people away from Christ. The Sebastian problem. But the problem is, with Sebastian, Christ is there in him, chasing him constantly in his face. And he blames it on his mother, because it's easy to say, I hate my mother. But if you read what Lady Brideshead says...
It's what Cordelia says about faith. It's like you make a false god.
Yeah.
You can't hate God, you can't hate Christ, but you... I don't know if she says Christ, but you say you can't hate God, so you make something else into a false version of God, and you hate that
thing. And you hate that thing, yeah. So for Sebastian, it's so easy to say, my mother, hate my mother. And his father, remember, Kara says, he hates her. He hates her. The father, the same problem. They just, you know, and I've met people like that, you know, a priest did something to my family when I was a teenager, and I'm never going to church because of that. And it's like, oh, well, that's convenient for you. You know, I'm so glad you had a nun once was mean to me, and that's it. Now I never have to think of religion again. Or they will kind of seize on any hypocrite that they ever meet that's a Christian and say, now I don't have to be a Christian because I met a hypocrite. But God is not going to let you get away with that. And so when you're, like in the character of Sebastian, who is a sensitive, he's geared towards the arts, he's geared towards the beautiful, God is going to keep coming and coming and coming. So there's only one escape, which is drink yourself into a stupor. You know, just keep drinking. And that's how you will handle the fact that you're fleeing from adulthood. And that's what he does all the way. But at the very end, he meets somebody who's more pathetic than he is by the grace of God. He meets somebody who needs him, who's this vile, disgusting, we think, you know, we kind of, the Kurtz thing is, you know, and so Sebastian is able to serve this man in a way that few of us would. How many of you would clean the putrid wound of a vile person? But Sebastian's been so broken by his thing, his journey, that he's able to do it in, because he has no sense of his own ego. He's no ego left. It's been demolished. And it allows him. And so then Cordelia has this quixotic statement where she says, oh, well, I think he died a saint. You know, I'm sure Sebastian's a saint. Because, you know, even though he's still a drunk, he has finally surrendered. And, you know, and in a weird way is happy. But it's a big price to pay, isn't it? What Sebastian pays for, you know, for his sanctity. So, okay. What's Charles's problem? Okay, so not growing up is Sebastian. How about Charles? What is Charles looking for?
A family.
Okay, family. All right, now he never had anybody who really cared for him in his life. He doesn't know, so I think that that's true. Now, what does that have to do with spirituality, the search for family for Charles? What do you think? What's Charles' problem with God?
Huh. He's an agnostic, isn't he?
He's an agnostic, right. He's an agnostic because he never thinks he needed God.
Right.
It was raised without it, and he has no reference point. But go ahead.
Is it like he doesn't feel loved by his family, so he doesn't feel like God could love him, maybe?
I think it starts there. I think that when you say somebody hasn't needed God, it's because they've figured out a way to survive. They've been surviving without that thing. But it's kind of like Charles is like a man in a desert. You know, he's subsisting, he's surviving without joy, without self-donation, without the desire to give, without laughter and beauty, until he meets Sebastian. He's literally a kind of a half-dead person. And then he meets Sebastian and falls in love. And again, I people go back and forth, were they gay or not? That's not relevant to the book. I don't think they were. I think you can say they're not because Anthony is. And they very much distinguish Sebastian from Anthony and Charles and Sebastian from Anthony. But,
I think the gay suggestion, mm-hmm. though, mm-hmm. is an extension of Waugh's description of the excessiveness in
yeah.
which Sebastian surrounded himself.
Yes.
There are lines that suggest Charles was in need of love, opens
mm-hmm.
the lower door in the wall, and
mm-hmm.
finds this garden of paradise, and all these
yeah.
things that later writers suggest were.
Yes, I think
references.
People read it too much with a contemporary thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sebastian is separated from Anthony. I mean, he's not Anthony, and Anthony is so clearly set out as being gay. And actually, not only set out as being gay, we're going to talk about Anthony in a minute because it's very dark, actually. Going back to Charles, you know, Charles is living a loveless, godless world. Then all of a sudden, he stumbles into this thing. But what's Charles' problem with God is he thinks he's irrelevant. And kind of a way. Almost a resentment there of, you know, I met someone who said to me once, if there is a God, why didn't he ever show himself to me? This woman said this to me. It always just stayed with me a lot, because imagine what God would have to do to someone who's living, walking through life with that attitude, you know, of, yeah, in other words, it's not enough, the mountains, the ocean. It's not enough, you know. I mean, who's the great, was it Whittaker Chambers who converted because he saw his little girl's ear? You know, and he was just so, the ear was so magnificent that he knew there must be a God. Like, I mean, that's just kind of openness to faith, that we talked about that last week. But you know, what would be, what would God have to do for this woman to say, you showed yourself to me, really? You know, I mean, what would it take? I don't know that there would be anything enough.
She made up her mind.
Yeah. And so Charles, in some ways, got the same kind of angry thing in him, that there can't be a God because I've never seen him. And that's why when he says to the, you know, to the flights, why do you have to bring up God? Why do you have to bring God into everything? And they're like, well, because he's there. And then he suddenly feels like odd man out, like he's the one missing something. But it's easier for him to then say, they're all nuts. They're all crazy, these people. They're obsessed with something that doesn't exist. They've made life much more complicated than it needs to be. And that's what's odd about Charles, is though, because he doesn't relate the thing he loves about them at all to their faith, but that's where it's coming from. That the attraction of the flights, their charm, is completely coming from their faith. But he wants that without their faith. He wants their charm. He wants their sensuality, their love of beauty, their openness and awareness. He wants, I mean, the charm of the flights. The charm is that they say things so that no one else will say. In a very, you know, like for example, Cordelia, when Charles says, when she leaves, she says, well, I didn't have a vocation. And Charles says, well, you'll fall in love. I said, oh, I pray not. I say, do you think I could have another of those scrumptious meringues? Like, this is a very flight quote. Quite a flighty thing to say, you know, it's a flighty thing to say, because it's so charming, you know, that that they would be so open, you know, and it's like Sebastian saying, oh, I wish it wasn't real. I mean, who's going to say that except one of the flights? So Charles is living a charmless, his problem is he has no charm, and he's living a charmless life. And then he encounters charm, and he begins to say, something in him begins to associate the two. The charm and the faith might be coming from the same place. And he rejects them both because he doesn't want the God stuff. So Charles's problem is, you know, it's like, what's going to fix Charles? How are you going to crack somebody who thinks it's all irrelevant? You know, what's going to do? And the question is, I think the book's theory, I mean, what do you think the book says? What is it that cracks Charles at the end? What is it that finally breaks him open? For those of you who got to the end, yeah.
His realization that when he said that prayer, there was a God.
Yeah.
When he revisited Brideshead.
Yeah.
And the place, the gift of time.
Yes.
Through the prism of time, he sees sees Brideshead as from a different perspective through the experience of his whole experience with Sebastian and then the prayer at the end when he just, his action informed the inspiration when he just prayed.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that's quite profound in terms of thinking when we're talking to people about religion, what you're going to do, but yeah.
I think you're right on. But I think it was a gamble on Charles's part that paid off, and I think that the real closing of him comes when he realizes, when he's in the army and he's back at Brideshead, that he sees the chapel open that was closed when the mother died, and that's where I think Waugh really kind of nails us, where he says, no matter all the obstacles, God will find you and bring you in and reel you in.
Yeah, there. I think that when he sees the chapel open again, it is. It's a moment of joy for him, which makes no sense, because why should he care? But knowing that that chapel is alive still, the family's gone, but the chapel endures. And it's what you said. It's time, really just time and reflection, a moment of grace, and then time. And what else happened? His heart got broken twice. Like, he absolutely had a broken heart, and then and complete terrible disappointments, and then time, and then has this grace of revisiting Brideshead. All the stupid places for his army group to end up, it's right there again. So that's the question. When you have someone whose heart is that hardened, I have no need of God. what is going to be the formula? Well, it's so mysterious about the, you know, all you can do is pray that they have a moment of grace and that somewhere along the line they finally crack. But it's not something you can argue them into, you know, or convince them into, or there's no word or proof. It's a time thing, and it's a lot of patience. And one day, they're different. And it's this the sum total of their journey. And they either get enough time to get there or they don't. And you just have no way of knowing. But, you know, Charles is, as the narrator of the story, the Wa is saying he is the most common person in the world. All the flights are kind of interesting, but Charles is the most. His story is the common one, and when you talk about the ramifications for then evangelization or sharing your faith or witnessing, it does make it interesting, doesn't it? Like, what do you do? What is it that people need from us? We're going to strike them as weird, you know? I mean, it really weird, but you have to be up for that. You can't not be who you are. So I think it's the question, you know? What was it that that finally saved Charles?
Wasn't the genius of the novel also that Wa was able to characterize Catholicism in a way that traditionally wasn't characterized at the time by English writers?
Well, by anybody, frankly. Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, I think that, you know, he's really, you're anticipating where I'm headed. I wanted to do one more character, which is Julia.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I want to get there. I want to get to what the Catholic thing is that Wa is saying is different. But let's talk about Julia quickly, because she's, you know, she is in many ways Julia is a version of Sebastian, but with a lot more human respect. She doesn't let herself go as far as her brother goes. But Julia has the best speech in the book. It's this amazing speech. And in the version by the BBC, they kept word for word this whole, like, three pages. But I want to read Julia's little speech because it's, you know, it summarizes her problem. But again, if you think of Julia as being typical of a lot of people out there, and maybe people here at the table, then... I think it's very helpful, but I think it's brilliant. So basically what happens here is Bridie says to Julia at the table, I'm going to bring my widow, I'm going to see my widow again. And Julia finally says, well, why don't you bring her up here? And Bridie says, well, I can't do that because you and Charles, you are irregular, aren't you? You know, Charles is horrified that he's so uncivil. That he would say such a mean thing. So she goes running out. He says, basically says, Bridie, what a bloody offensive thing to say to Julia. Charles says this, and then Bridie says, well, there was nothing she should object to. I was merely stating a fact well known to her. Okay. So he goes out to the fountain, and basically Charles thinks he's going out to say to Julia, oh, that awful Bridie, what a jerk. You and I, you know, how terrible and what a jerk and what a hypocrite he is. Instead, he goes up to Julia and he says, how dare he speak to you like that, I said. No, she said, it's not that. He's quite right. They know all about it, Bridie and his widow. They've got it in black and white. They bought it for a penny at the church door. You can get anything there for a penny in black and white. And speak about insanity. This whole sequence now sounds like somebody who's losing it, right? But I think intentionally. You can get anything there for a penny in black and white, and nobody to see that you pay. Only an old woman with a broom at the other end rattling around the confessionals, and a young woman lighting a candle at the Seven Dolors. Put a penny in the box, or not, just as you like. Take your tract. There, you've got it in black and white. all in one word, too, one little flat, deadly word that covers a lifetime, living in sin. Not just doing wrong, as I did when I went to America. Doing wrong, knowing it is wrong, stopping doing it, forgetting. That's not what they mean. That's not Bridie's Pennyworth. He means just what it says in black and white. Living in sin, with sin, by sin, for sin, every hour, every day, year in, year out. Waking up with sin in the morning, seeing the curtains drawn on sin, bathing it, dressing it, clipping diamonds to it, feeding it, showing it round, giving it a good time, putting it to sleep at night with a tablet of dial if it's fretful. Always the same, like an idiot child, carefully nursed, guarded from the world. Poor Julia, they say, she can't go out, she's got to take care of her little sin. A pity it ever lived, they say, but it's so strong. Children are like that always are. Julia's so good to her little mad sin. An hour ago, I thought under the sunset, she sat turning her ring in the water and counting the days of happiness. Now under the first stars and the last gray whisper of day, all this mysterious tumult of sorrow. What had happened to us? So she was beside herself, her voice now muffled in my breast, now clear and anguished, came to me in single words and broken sentences. Past and future. The years when I was trying to be a good wife, in the cigar smoke, when time crept on and the counters clicked on the backgammon board, and the man who was dummy at the men's table filled the glasses, when I was trying to bear his child, torn in pieces by something already dead, putting him away, forgetting him, finding you, the past 2 years with you, all the future with you, all the future with or without you, war coming, world-ending sin. A word from so long ago, from Nanny Hawkins stitching by the hearth and the nightlight burning before the Sacred Heart. Cordelia with me in the catechism in Mummy's room before luncheon on Sundays. Mummy carrying my sin with her to church, bowed under it in the black lace veil in the chapel, slipping out with it in London before the fires were lit, taking it with her through the empty streets where the milkman's ponies stood with their forefeet on the pavement. Mummy dying with my sin, eating at her, more cruelly than her own deadly illness. Mummy dying with it, Christ dying with it, nailed hand and foot, hanging over the bed in the night nursery, hanging year after year in the dark little study at Farm Street. So then she goes on here. But it's magnificent, really. What is this character's problem? What is Julia, what's Julia thinking? What's making Julia be this way? Anybody want to share what they think is going on with her here?
When I started just reading a book, I had a feeling that Julia is like saint.
She's what?
Like saint. She's doing.
I'm sorry. What? Sane.
Yeah, sane? She's doing many like good things, mm-hmm. helping, organizing events, and. Mm-hmm. Promotions or mm-hmm. something like that.
She's being a lady, she's doing her duty.
Yeah, and then mm-hmm. all of a sudden her character opens up and she's just like a spoiled girl mm-hmm. who doesn't have any limits and mm-hmm. marries just because she wants to show everybody that she's independent. Mm-hmm. And she's like 20 years old. Like so many mistakes one after mm-hmm. another. So I think what you've read, I didn't come to that page, I think eventually she realized who she was. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the way the statement that she feels even guilty in front of your mom.
Yeah, she's this. It's interesting because the question before, what could save Charles? Well, nothing we could do. But Julia is pretty much saved by Bridie putting it to her and saying to her, well, you are a regular, aren't you? I'm not going to bring my wife to be around you because you're living in sin. And for Julia, this cracks her wide open.
I think there was a quote on that I think sums Julia up, and maybe Sebastian as well, maybe the whole book. But I'll read it if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. So it's towards the end, and her father's about to die. And Sebastian goes, or Charles says, I'm sorry, the nearer our marriage got, the more wistfully I noticed Julia spoke of it. War was growing nearer, too. We neither of us doubted that, but Julia's tender, remote, it sometimes seemed desperate longing did not come from any uncertainty outside of herself. It suddenly darkened, too, into brief accesses of hate when she seemed to throw herself against the restraints of her love for me, like a caged animal against the bars.
Mm. What does it mean to you?
Oh my gosh, it's like, mm-hmm. I'm still thinking about that. Mm-hmm. line, but I think the restraints of her love for Charles are, it's her conscience.
It's her conscience.
Mm. She just,
yeah,
it's her faith. Mm-hmm. She knows that it's wrong mm-hmm. to be with him.
Mm-hmm.
And she's railing against it with all that she is, but she's still,
yeah,
you know.
It was the same with husband.
Yeah. The question is, how long is she going to keep it up? Now, Sebastian keeps it up by drinking, you know, and but Julia isn't an alcoholic. So she has to kind of just shut down. And, you know, Julia has almost nothing, very little to say. And then all of a sudden she comes out with all of this. So, but yeah, Julia, her conscience is not, she finally surrenders to the fact that she's not going to be able to flee her own conscience. She may hate, she may not understand why she has it. She may hate that it's there. And in fact, I think she does. I think that's the source of her anger. She wishes she could shut her conscience out so she could just be with the man she loves, but she can't. And she fights it for a while and then finally surrenders. And she has to surrender at the moment of the miracle, even not knowing that it was Charles' prayer. Even just witnessing the father's action at the end is a miracle. If she knew it was Charles' prayer that made it happen, it would be even more so. But because of the miracle, basically, the miracle says to Julia, God exists. I cannot do this anymore. I can't live a lie.
Which I think mm-hmm. obviously requires a lot of courage.
And tremendous. Yeah.
Because let's say somebody who's mm-hmm. married. She's married. She's married and she falls in love with another man
yeah.
who's also married.
Mm-hmm.
And they shouldn't be in love,
mm-hmm.
but they are.
Yeah.
And so they try it out for a while, but then at the end, they finally are able to break it off. I think they should have never been in love to begin with, but to break it off, I think that shows a lot of courage.
Well, and it does, and it's I think even magnified in the book by what does she do next? She goes off to France to be a nurse. Because when you've fought this battle, there's nothing else you're afraid of. Do you know? It's like, so for Julia to go and, like, you're kind of like, she's what? You know, but of course she is. Because now that I've decided this major battle, nothing life can throw at me is going to be scary to me. And so there she goes. But, I mean, so Julia is someone who is the situation she is. She's away from God because of human love. So the character, and there are many, many people like that, huh? Right? They can't, one of my great famous, Carol Hausmandler, my favorite spiritual writer, she says, there's nothing so hard to oppose when you're talking to people or when you encounter it, that a cold dogma versus a warm human beating heart. And so someone says to you, but I love her, or but I love him, or but my father will break his heart if I, you know, became a Christian. Or, you know, I remember one guy came to these classes a few years ago, Chris, and he won't mind me telling you the story, but he really wanted to go become a Catholic finally, but he said, it will devastate my father. I can't break my father's heart because he's been a long-time Protestant, you know, in Kentucky forever, and my brothers and my father, it will separate me. I can't do it. So I said, you know, go in peace. See how that works out for you to live your call with God based on afraid of making your father unhappy. And so he went a couple years and then met a woman and on eHarmony, and they were perfect for each other. And she was an evangelical woman, and when they got together and it seemed like, wow, this is beautiful and we're in love, and just before they start really getting into it, she said, there's just something I have to tell you which might be a deal breaker for you. I know, you know, we both shared that we're both good evangelicals, but I think I have to become a Catholic. And he was so happy. So he comes running to me saying, the woman I'm in love with is a Catholic and wants to be Catholic, and so do I. And so what happened there was he loved his father, but he loved Erica more at this point. And it allowed him to do the thing he hadn't been doing, he couldn't do before. But you wonder how long he would have lived with that, you know, I don't want to break my father's heart thing. But I think a lot of people are stuck in this, you know. They fall in love with someone, and or they love someone, you know, and it becomes really, really hard. I have one friend who, you know, both of her brothers are homosexuals, and they are because they were both molested. And it's a very, very tragic, sad story. But she's like, I can never be a Christian because Christians hate gays and I love my brothers. And, you know, so it's a very slow process of saying Christians don't hate anybody, you know, that's in consonant with being a Christian. But it's, in her mind, it's like, it's all wrapped up. Being angry at God is all wrapped up in loving her brothers. And it's very hard there because love is good. Love is always good. And she just loves, like you can't, like Julie and Charles' love is good. The expression of it is wrong. But that's the tricky thing, is to say to people, your love is always good, you know, but it becomes very hard. So Julie is caught in that trap of I finally have found love and it's so wonderful and good. How can I walk away for this stupid religion thing? But I can't get away from it. I can't. And so finally she surrenders. But it's a beautiful journey for the character, I think. And again, I think very, very common. So then the question is, yeah, what is it that saves Julia? Somebody tells her the truth. And so the thing that's going to save Julia is not the thing that's going to save Charles. And to tell you the truth, if somebody had said it to Sebastian, you are a hopeless drunk because you're trying to run away from being a grown-up. I mean, he might have killed himself. So it wouldn't have been the same thing to save Sebastian. So let's get now at, we'll spend the last bit of time here on this charm thing. Because it really is...
Are we also going to talk about Anthony?
Oh, and Anthony. Okay, yeah, let's go to... Well, Anthony is the one who talks about charm the most. So let's look at Anthony. And so Anthony's character... Somebody tell me about Anthony. Anybody, what do you thought of Anthony? How does he approach himself? What's Anthony's story about God and faith or any of this stuff? What do you think? Anybody? Okay, well, yes. Okay, well, let's read a few things about Anthony Blanche. Okay, so first of all, his name is Anthony White. Okay, Blanche in French. Okay. Let me read you a couple things, and you tell me who this sounds like. Okay. First of all, Anthony speaks with a...
Okay.
Oh, a
stutter.
He has a...
I don't think it's
a listener. No, right? Yeah, okay, anyway, just hold that in your brain. But, okay, this I did not need telling was Anthony Blanche, the aesthete par excellence, a byword of iniquity, a young man who seemed to me then fresh from the somber company of the college essay society, ageless as a lizard. So Anthony is ageless as a lizard. I just want you to think of who he's describing here.
Somebody sleepy.
Well, first of all, isn't that an odd way to say somebody's ageless? Ageless as a lizard?
I thought it was odd considering that they were 18 years old.
Okay, right. So he's ageless, but a lizard is already wrinkled and scaly. So it's true, when you look at a lizard, you're like, is this lizard 80 years old or is it 400 years old? But you don't think it's a newborn, right? So ageless as a lizard is the first thing. Okay. Then the next thing he says, I had heard his voice in the George challenging the conventions, Anthony. And now meeting him under the spell of Sebastian, I found myself enjoying him voraciously. After luncheon, he stood on the balcony with a megaphone and in languishing, sobbing tones, recited passages from The Wasteland. This is Anthony. Okay. Anthony says to Sebastian, my dear, I should like to stick you full of barbed arrows like a pincushion. Now, of course, you know Saint Sebastian is martyred by all the arrows pierced through him. So Anthony says to Sebastian, I'd like to stick you through with arrows like a pincushion. Let me read another Anthony, a couple Anthonys, and you start telling me who it starts to sound like to you. All right. 46. Yeah, let's go to 46. So the only thing we really know of Lady Flight, or Lady Brideshead, is through Anthony first, right? Anthony's the one who warns Sebastian to avoid the flights because of their deadly charm, their awful charm. It's evil. Okay. Anthony, this is a description of him. His vices flourished less in the pursuit of pleasure than in the wish to shock. He was competitive in the bet you can't do this style. He was cruel, too, in the wanton insect-maiming manner of the very young and fearless, like a little boy charging head down, small fists whirling. Couple more, 58. Anthony's effect. Okay, so this, having been with Anthony, Charles writes, the figures of nightmare were already racing through my brain as throughout the wakeful hours I repeated to myself Anthony's words, catching his accent soundlessly and the stress and cadence of his speech, while under the closed lips I saw his pale, candlelit face as it fronted me across the dinner table. Once, during the hours of darkness, I brought to light the drawings in my sitting room and sat at the open window turning them over. Everything was black. Only at the quarter hours the bells awoke and sang over the gables. I drank soda water and smoked and fretted until light began to break. So after having spent an evening with Anthony, that's where Charles is. Okay, and last, 61, Anthony. Anthony's charm. I just wanted to find out how much truth there was in what Anthony said last night. I shouldn't think a word. That's his great charm. You may think it's charming. I think it's devilish. Okay. So in other words, I wanted to find out how much truth there was in what Anthony said. I shouldn't think there's a word of it was true. That's his great charm. Who is the one who never says the truth? Satan. But think of all of these things, and if you stand back from the book, I think Anthony is the voice of the devil in this story. He's ageless as a lizard. He hates the flights, and especially Lady Brideshead. She's evil. She makes people miserable. She's wicked. She'll fill you with anxiety if you go around her. She'll ruin your peace. He never says a word that isn't a lie. And then he has this distressing effect of after you leave him, you experience tremendous anxiety and paranoia and a sense of darkness. So when you realize that Anthony is Satan, then everything he says now, you go back to the book and read it again. And it turns out that, yes, he has the one that calls it the flight charm, this beware of it, this distressing charm. And it's Satan. So I think you can find that in the book. I think it's very, very interesting. And then you want to go back and look at Anthony's character. So when Sebastian is hanging around Anthony, he's literally flirting with this terrible, terrible dark side, which is telling him, your mother is evil, and you should flee it. You should get away from it. And Anthony, Sebastian will lose himself in the company of Anthony. Let's end with this charm thing, okay, because we've led up to it. The charm of the flights. All right, so here's some examples of it. So Sebastian's talking to Charles, and he says, "No one knows Papa. He's a social leper. Hadn't you heard?" And the truth is, he is a social leper. It's a truth, but no one would say it, you know. Here's another Sebastian. Sebastian, idly turning the page of Clive Bell's art, read, "Does anyone feel the same kind of emotion for a butterfly or a flower that he feels for a cathedral or a picture? Yes, I do."
Who said yes, I do?
Sebastian. Oh. Sebastian. Here's another one. Let's see, blah, blah, blah. Good. Okay. He writes that he was under the spell of Sebastian, right? Sebastian's nanny was seated at the open window. The fountain lay before her, the lakes, the temple, and far away on that last spur, a glittering obelisk. Her hands lay open in her lap, and loosely between them, a rosary. She was fast asleep. Long hours of work in her youth, authority in middle life, repose and security in her old age had set their stamp on her lined and serene face. That's charm. That picture is very charming of this serene woman now at the end of life. There's nothing she wants. She is happy and she's waiting for the next thing. It's extremely charming. And then she opens her eyes, Sebastian, and she looks. She says, "Who's this looking at me? I don't think I know him." Again, this kind of absolutely in your face, out there, no pretense thing. Here's Sebastian Charm again. "I'm ashamed of myself," said Sebastian gravely. "I'm not going to have you get mixed up with my family. They're so madly charming. All my life, they've been taking things away from me. If they once got hold of you with their charm, they'd make you their friend, not mine. And I won't let them." It was a charming room. Oddly shaped to conform with the curve of the dome. The walls were papered in a pattern of ribbon and rose. There was a rocking horse in a corner and an oleograph of the Sacred Heart over the mantelpiece, and he goes on. It was a charming room. They use this word charm continuously. So, the flight charm is this weird combination of truth-telling, blatant truth-telling, especially about themselves. Where there's no lying in them. And even in being drunks and being, you know, guilty, they're honest. That's Julia's problem, right? She's like, "No, what he said was absolutely true. We're living in sin." And then she speaks all of these things that few of us would ever say. So they can absolutely say the stuff that nobody else says. And that's tremendously compelling to be around. Have you ever met somebody who just blatantly spoke the truth all the time? Sometimes disconcerting, but fascinating. It's like a spell is cast on you if you're around someone who has no pretense. The question is, where do they get the no pretense thing? What is it in their life that makes them that way? What do you think? Because that's that Catholic thing. This ability to be very earthy and especially about yourself and say, "Yeah, I'm struggling with jealousy. And the truth is I'm green-eyed jealous of so-and-so. Yep, that's me." Like, that is Catholicism at its best. Where does it come from?
Has to be the voice of God himself speaking.
Mm-hmm. But why don't other Christians have it then? What is the difference?
That's what I was just
going to
ask.
Right. What is the difference? Because he's calling it that Catholic thing. And remember, Charles is coming from a Christian family, but the flights stand out in British society because they're Catholic and they have this charm. Where does it come from? What do you think?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it comes from pain because, I'm totally just going with faith here in terms of my best friend, Charlie, his father was shot by his mother when he was a kid and he held his father dying. And Charlie has so much charm and just says what no one else will say and it endears everyone to, I don't know.
Well, I mean, the pain thing is interesting because that isn't unique to Catholics, right? Other people have pain. What is it? I'm going to say it's the sacraments.
I was going to say that. But I didn't know why.
Yeah. I mean, let's look at it. What are the sacraments? And this book is full of the kind of the smells and the bells, the textures and the as well as the sacraments. And of course it culminates in the last sacrament. But if you think about it, the Catholic thing is this earth meeting heaven thing, where you have, you gnaw on bread that's the body of Christ, right? You taste the wine that's the blood of Christ. You feel the oil dripping on your forehead. You hear yourself saying your sins, and you hear back, words of penance and forgiveness. You know, the earthiness of the sacraments, if you live them, they strip away from you pretense, and they make you, very, like, if you've gone to confession weekly or every other week for 40 years, and you've said, I did this and this and this, and I've done this and this and this pretty much every month for the last 40 years, and here I am again saying I've done this and this and this. Suddenly, if someone says, what's your problem? Even not in the context of confession, you're like, oh, yeah, well, I do this and this and this. You know, it's one of my things is, like there's an earthiness there. But the sacraments themselves, because they're physical and they're rooted in earthy stuff, they give to people who practice a sacramental life an earthy quality, a real quality that is, especially in this context, of a cerebral Christianity. British Christianity is basically, a cerebral Christianity. They stand out, like, in a very huge way. Yes.
Native Americans have that quality of being self-effacing and mm-hmm. open and mm-hmm. earthy. Mm-hmm. Is there anything within their religions of there's sort of pantheistic view of God that mm-hmm. is similar to the sacraments?
I don't know,
that gives them that earthiness too?
I don't know enough about them. But I'll tell you one other tradition where I find the same quality in its different degree is it the Jews. Mm-hmm. There is a real, no pretense, down to earth, gritty way. In fact, Jewish humor is very often based in this, mm-hmm. right? People just say, blah, blah, blah. And everyone goes, I can't believe you just said that. But but I think in a lot of our rituals, our sacraments are derived from
yes.
Jewish rituals, so there's something about the ritualized practice of the faith, and especially this faith, that Evelyn Waugh is going to say that Catholic thing is this gritty, earthy quality, the inability to have too much pretense that just comes to you from dwelling in the sacraments, in the sacramental life. It brings with it, too, this openness to beauty and the world. And in a way, you can experience and enjoy the world on a whole different level. And that's part of the charm of it. So people who are truly living, who are living a sacramental life, it's kind of imbued in them, they're going to have this quality of joy and openness and adventure. They're not living in the same kind of closed down obtuseness of spirit and or even imprisoned by fear and pride and all these things that would inhibit people from seeing. So this is the kind of appeal of the flights that people can't, they find them addictive. They're fascinating. And you will find if you go ahead and seriously practice your faith as you do, you will have the same effect on people. They will say to you, there's something different about you. Or I for some reason, I've had people say to me, and I am, not lately, but in my youth when I was much more intense about stuff, but I used to have people come up to me and say, I remember one time, very strangely, a guy called me, and I had worked with him on the lot at Fox on a project. Never really talked to him about having been a Christian. He called me up and he said, my daughter, they just found out my daughter has cancer. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. And I'd worked him in a one-sheet campaign. We'd never had a single conversation about religion. And he said, I don't know why, but I think you're the kind of person who would pray for my daughter, and I don't know anybody else. Would you pray for my daughter? And I was like, well, as a matter of fact, I am the kind of person who would pray for your daughter. But and then I said, I know some priests. Would you like? He said, no, I don't know if that would be too much. But, I'm just so distressed. Would you pray for my daughter? And I was like, yeah, I'll pray for your daughter. And if you want to pray with me at some point, But anyway, I was always stand back from that and thought how remarkable it was that he kind of knew. He just knew. And the question is, you know, are we living it seriously enough that that we stand out among the panoply of people who are basically rushing about, you know, not living the examined life and not really living life to the full? The question is, are we, you know, do we stand out at all?
Did that caller know you were a nun?
No, he didn't. He only knew me as, you know, a person who, I mean, maybe he'd seen me have a cross on or something, but we worked on a project on it. We did a one sheet campaign together and he was a graphic artist, but we never talked about religion. But it just, to me, was so strange that he had this terrible thing happen that was so outside his ability to cope. And he there was nothing on earth he could buy to fix it. And he thought of me and called me and asked me if I would say a prayer. And so anyway, it's just, I think that the difference in you will shine out. But the flight charm, I mean, the funny thing about it is they're fighting it so hard, but it's still part of who they are. They can't get away from it. And that's one of the great ironies of the story. Cordelia just accepts it. You know, she accepts it in the same way I didn't have a vocation. Oh, well. You know, that's why I think she's holy. She's completely able to not fight God's will. The others are still engaged in this terrible fight. I just found another great line about Sebastian. Sebastian is in love with his own childhood. I mean, it's a great, there it is. He doesn't want to grow up. So anyway, if you didn't finish Bride's Head, I would encourage you to, just because I think that, was that an accident?
No.
Good. Because I think that many, many issues about grace and about salvation.
Redemption.
And then this bigger question of what does living the sequela Christi, the radical following of Christ, what does it really mean in a human life? And I think Bride's Head has that.
What does that mean, sequela?
Sequela Christi is a Latin expression for the radical following of Christ. You know, the radical path of Christ.
Does secular come from sequela?
No, this is, sequela is a different, no, it's a different spelling.
Latin root?
Yeah, it's S-E-Q, so, yeah, oh. Yeah. I used to know what secular came from, but I've been away from my Latin for a few years. It's actually an interesting thing. Secular is something like garbage, but I should just say, I remember the Latin root is very funny when you hear it. So, anyway, I hope you. I like to do Bride's Head at the beginning of this course because it kind of lays out all of the issues of why we're even here talking about all this stuff. You know,
and it has a happy ending.
It does in a very, you know, you're more cheerful today,
yeah,
than you were, than I've noticed lately, you know, which is a lovely, graceful, gentle kind of next step, you know, there.
I'm surprised you didn't mention, I think it was
Rex.
Charles is talking to Cordelia and quotes the detective novel or something.
Oh, the Father Brown series?
Yeah. And he talks about the string that stretches out there and with the hook, and no matter how far it gets out there, mm-hmm. you get reeled back in. I mean, mm-hmm. that sort of sums up the whole thing up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You know, there's so many great lines like that, too, and I love that part. I mean, one of my favorite subplots in the book is Rex, the character of... Julia's guy, and he's one of these people who has zero intellectual or spiritual curiosity.
Rex,
you know, and so he's the one that Cordelia kind of ridicules by telling about the sacred monkeys of the Vatican, you know, and he's like, fine, okay, Jesus resurrected from the dead, fine, sacred monkeys, fine, Eucharist, fine, you know, and the Jesuit who's teaching him says, he's like half a person, you know, he has no spiritual or intellectual curiosity, he doesn't care about the truth at all.
But then Then he emerges at the end as described by the Nettie, mm-hmm. as being quite outspoken, an outspoken politician.
Yeah, he becomes a successful politician.
Hero. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it's quite ironic that he's saying that he becomes a successful politician because he's a man who has absolutely no regard for the truth. but Julia says about him, he's not really a whole man. So interesting that Julia says that, because Julia's suffering this terrible journey, you know, of inner loathing and conscience, and yet she knows in that journey she's still a person who's alive and alert. And in the fight itself, I'd rather be me with this terrible fight than Rex, who's only half a man, because he's not fighting anything, which is kind of funny. So you kind of know when Julia says that, she's not going to be able to hold out much longer, you know, because Julia could never be a Rex. You know, she wishes she could, I think, at some point, and then she's like, no, I don't want to be that, you know. But have you ever met a Rex? You know, I mean, somebody who absolutely, for this, you know, really? Yeah, I mean, there are people out there. They have no spiritual, they've shut down every spiritual context reference. Their whole life is acquisitiveness, either power or money, and there is no filter at all. So, it, you know, Rex doesn't care. He's like, he wants Julia, so I'll do whatever you tell me, sure, you know, and it just keeps getting more and more absurd. And then the question is, why does Julia marry him? It's an act of a temper tantrum, basically. It's a teenage rebellion where she says, I will not serve. I'm going to marry him. And then she does, and it's misery. It's abject misery.
Well, so how does that explain then how he becomes this outspoken, passionate, you know, against the Nazis?
Well, you know, it's a good question, isn't it? You know, is it just that knowing Rex as we do, unlikely that he's had a conversion to the truth. This is about the moment. In the moment, the way of rising to the top of the pack is to be this thing. And that's what Rex does.
She was trying to be expedient.
Yeah.
For the time where England was.
Yeah. If Rex was in Nazi Germany, he'd be
thing.
In the Gestapo.
Yeah, this is the thing. I'll do it. What do you want me to do? Okay, let's do it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, Rex has no filter, no moral filter, no spiritual filter, nothing. He's half a man. So, anyway, I love this book. It's a very, you know, I think it's a brilliant, brilliant book. And yeah.
For the first 330 pages, I'm like, why is she having a freak? And then the comes together at the end. But.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does come together at the end if it's just about plot. But when you go back and read it again, as I say, I've been through it about 15 times now, you really start to see all these other layers there. So, for example, I didn't catch on to the Anthony thing until like about reading number 10. I didn't put all those. Then I went through and I started reading all the Anthony quotes, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy's the devil. And then you read everything he says with that eye of he's lying, and it makes a whole huge part of the book. You see it in a different light. And then you realize he's the one who made us hate Lady Brideshead. He's the one who you get set up.
By the way, I wanted more of her. When she died, kind of
yeah, she's
like, out of
she's
nowhere.
Out
I was like,
you.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Well, you know, if you do find yourself looking at Lady Brideshead askance, it's because Anthony set you up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so then when you go back and read it again, you realize actually everything she says, Lady Brideshead says in the book, is lovely and good and holy. And patient and loving.
I wanted to have a little talk with her.
There you go, a little talk.
She reads out loud in the living room.
She reads out loud, you know. But she's actually quite a lovely person. It's just we saw her through Satan's eyes. So.
Is there homosexual sentiment then that he's Satan?
No, I mean I think that would be that, you know, there might be some of that, you know, the convention of the time, but I don't think you know, I mean, I think that he's using this character who is for Sebastian the doorway into darkness, and so he puts him in that extreme life because Sebastian is a person of extremes. And so there it is, you know. But, you know, he could be making a commentary, you know. I don't know. I don't know if I want to go that far with it. I never have to say, is he saying that all homosexuals are the devil? I don't see that in it. But this one definitely is. You know, he's too. There's too many references that you know you can find. Ageless as a lizard,
and stuttering is. There's a Freudian element.
He has a forked tongue.
Like
oh,
yeah. It's a forked
like
tongue.
Oh.
That's fine. It all fits.
It speaks to some psychopathology from a Freudian perspective.
Yeah.
A stutter represents some kind of arrested development or...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it does. It definitely does. And, you know, it would indicate, you know, he's so much a creature of the lying Anthony that he, you know, it's like it half comes out and it gets stuttered on the way, you know. But I think it fits. It's a great, he's just a great character. And it, but then when you unpack it, it's like, whoa, whoa. So good. Okay, well, enough. We're going to let you go. So have a happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Thank you. Thank you. And if you don't have a place to go, noon mass here on Holy Thursday, on Thanksgiving.